I find this fascinating. One of these projects you're working on is to really help us understand the definition of what is democracy. What has democracy become here up in the United States, and what are some of the hopes we're seeing down in South and Central America today? What inspired you to take on a project like this?
Everywhere we've been, I've spent a number of years in Latin America. You know, I'm from the United States, and mm-hmm. I've lived in Europe. And everywhere you go, you always hear these people saying, oh, no, that, you know, that country, that's not a democracy, especially here in Venezuela. I'm in Venezuela right now. I live in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're in Venezuela, you hear from the United States, well, that's not a democracy. Hugo Chavez, he's a dictatorship.
Our own vice president has said that.
How is that? Well, what's our definition of democracy? I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the more and more you see these experiences all across the hemisphere, really, and, you know, that's what our documentary that we just recently finished, Beyond Elections, is all about, these exciting experiences of participatory democracy, where people on a local level are participating in the decisions in their communities, and also in regional and national decisions,
mm-hmm.
In ways that most of us in the United States would just find absolutely phenomenal and amazing. But so, you know, seeing all these different experiences, all these different ideas all across the hemisphere, I said, wait, you know, that's really the crux of the question here. What is democracy, really?
Right, right. And again, you know, according to, well, the last administration's view of it was, as long as people are voting, then we have a democracy. And there's obviously
right.
a lot more to that. And obviously, I've spent a lot of time on my show talking about what's been happening in Venezuela, what's been happening in Bolivia, remarkable. And actually, it seems in very many instances, the whole region is sort of inspired by what's happened with Chavez and with Evo Morales in Bolivia, and there is a rethinking going on down there. I think a lot of people in that, maybe I'm wrong, in that part of the world view America through the prism of American corporations and what they've done to the region there.
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way to change that, or is that part of what's fueling some of the movement toward a new democracy down there?
I mean, I think it's really important to understand not just U.S. corporations, but the role of U.S. intervention in Latin America
mm-hmm.
since the beginning of our country, and not just the United States, but obviously European. Just to take a look at, say, the last 150 years, you know, the United States has had a role in the overthrow of governments all across Latin America. And if you look at just, for instance, the dictatorships of the 1960s and 1970s with Argentina and mm-hmm. Brazil and Paraguay, and Plan Condor was actually coordinated through the United States. Plan Condor was obviously kind of the U.S.-backed plan to unite the intelligence agencies of all these military dictatorships, which caused the disappearance of, say, 30,000 in Argentina and the torture of tens or hundreds of thousands all across the region. And so that, I think, is really we're seeing, you know, people kind of fighting back in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
To U.S. intervention, U.S. policy in the region, and B, the Washington Consensus of the 1990s, free trade policies based on the IMF and the World Bank, which basically told people that they needed to privatize everything, get rid of their state programs, get rid of their social programs, and that was really going to help the country be able to develop. And what you saw, Venezuela was one of the first countries in 1989 to try that, and what happened was the Caracazo, when suddenly prices shot up three times and people rioted in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of what you're seeing across Latin America is finally, for the first time, these countries and also people are being able to take control of their lives and saying, wait a second, these policies aren't for us, they don't work for us, their policies being dictated from above, and I think that's part of the reason why you're seeing this huge kind of movement towards local participatory democracy. For
mm-hmm.
instance, in Brazil, when you had the end of the Brazilian dictatorship in 1984, it was only 5 years later when you had participatory budgeting, for instance, in Porto Alegre, which, whereby local citizens can participate and decide where, you know, some of the funds of their city are going to go to, what projects are they going to go to. So it's local participatory democracy, people started to say, because they had come away from these dictatorships where they had nothing. And so
mm-hmm.
it was really kind of an answer, and people were saying, you know, wait a second, we want democracy, and we want real democracy. And that's one of the things I think is really important, Jeff, to so, you know, your listeners understand this as well, is oftentimes when we look at Latin America, most people, they focus on the presidents, which is very important because obviously most of the presidents in Latin America right now are left-leaning or progressive. But it's also important to look at the social movements, look at the autonomous movements, look at the, you know, the local grassroots participation. And that's actually a book I'm working on right now with a friend of mine and a number of people here and also in the United States. And it's a book focused on the social movements, interviews with social movements in Venezuela. The idea of trying to move away from, okay, this Chavez centrist focus on Venezuela is Chavez and Chavez is Venezuela. Say, well, wait, but what are the local community media stations doing? What's the local, you know, the grassroots campesino organization doing? And how are they organizing? How do they relate with the local government? And letting them speak for themselves. And that's part of what we try to do with our documentary, mm-hmm. was really allow people to tell their story. Because that's what democracy is. It's allowing people to speak for themselves, say what they need, and then take the steps to actually acquire that.
Well, it's interesting. This whole notion of local participatory democracy is something that I think Americans up here in North America are very much longing for at this point. We're grappling now with all of these institutions, whether it be on Wall Street or in Detroit, that have somehow become too big to fail. And most citizens feel that it's just out of their control, out of anyone's control to get a handle on the direction our country is moving in. So I think, part of what you're doing is maybe we should start looking to the South for examples of how people are reclaiming democracy.
We in the United States have to be looking to the South. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, we've always looked to the South and we said, well, let us help you fix your problems. Mm-hmm. And what Latin Americans have been saying for years and years is, no, you deal with your own problems and we'll fix our problems, but don't come down here and tell us how to fix ours. So we really need to be looking towards, you know, the alternatives, the positive alternatives happening in the South. And then also figure out a way to, you know, then take from that what we can and mix it with what we already know, you know, because obviously you can't just take something from someplace and implant it wherever you are, mm-hmm. but we need to learn from them. One of the things that's fascinating, Jeff, and I think really, really important, last fall, my wife and I, who's my partner on the documentary as well, mm-hmm. Sylvia, we drove around the country. We went from the East United States. We went from the East Coast to the West Coast and back to the East Coast, showing beyond elections, kind of all over the place. Mm-hmm. Universities or local community centers in Oklahoma City was just in a living room because that's who was around and that's what we could do. And it was amazing because at the same time we were showing this movie, we were also filming people for our next documentary, which is we're also working on right now, and hopefully we'll have it out this fall, which is essentially, you know, asking North Americans, people from the United States, to, you know, what do you think? What do we need? Where do you think our government is going? And you know, what are your thoughts? Now, obviously, when we were filming this, it was the lead up to the elections. It was right when the economic crash really, you know, hit hard, September and October. But it was fascinating to hear people, and this really struck me hard all across the country. And I'm talking from indigenous communities in South Dakota to truck drivers in Texas to farmers in Oklahoma City to the inner city in Los Angeles. Everybody saying the exact same thing, from the right to the left. Get them all out. You know, mm-hmm. Washington is not working for us. And I think that's what, you know, North Americans, what people from the United States voted last year, obviously. And that's what people really need to take that and run with it. Because we can't forget that, yes, Obama's in office, and that's fantastic. But at the same time, you know, only, you know, will he be able to actually carry out some of these initiatives. Only will he actually be able to pass some of this, you know, democracy or power down to the people if we're really saying, no, this is what we need, and we need to stand up for this. But it was extremely powerful to hear all these stories, so many of them the same, and everyone saying the same thing. We you know, Washington doesn't represent us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so then my question is, what do we need to do to get back to a place where we are being not just representative, but we're actually participating in decisions in our own lives, in our community, and also regionally and nationally?
Well, I think one of the big struggles is that the kind of voices you are hearing when you're out there doing, you know, interviewing people around the country aren't the kind of messages that are getting into the mainstream. The mainstream conversation is being controlled by the corporate, by the very interests that are controlling the politicians as well. And so these kind of things, the kind of stories that you're finding out there, coast to coast, left and right, aren't bubbling up. The people are, again, just adding to further alienation among the general citizens as to what this country is anymore.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the only way we can do it, because obviously We're not funded by large corporations and private mainstream media. You know, we're doing out of the donations when we show our film here and there, and that helps us to get gas to go to the next spot and out of our own pocket. And that's one of the difficult things for you know, independent grassroots people who, wherever they are, is, you know, how to find this funding when everything is so dominated by the mainstream media, and then also how to get this information out there, because, you know, beyond elections, it's been fantastic. We've been getting it out there. It's on the web, and you know people have been hearing about it, but obviously, you know, it's not on any of the mainstream TV shows that would really bump up its popularity there. But that's understandable, because they don't have an interest in actually getting the word out.
Tell me a little bit about Radio Venezuela en Vivo. Tell me about the inspiration for that, and obviously taking the message directly to the people. It seems like what you're trying to do there.
Exactly. Well, Radio Venezuela en Vivo, it was an initiative that started in, you know, the fall 2007, right around the time that you had the Venezuelan recall the constitutional referendum that was an election that happened here in November 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a very complicated issue. And there was a lot of information that there was going to be destabilization attempts and whatnot. And really, people didn't know what was going to happen. And they didn't know what the issues were about, nor internationally, nor nationally. And so there was a group of us, a couple dozen international folks, some of them English and French and from the United States and kind of all over the place, that said, you know what? We really need to come together and give people a source of news and information 24 hours during this referendum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have elections here in Venezuela, there's almost always rumors of coup attempts and destabilizations and whatnot. And what we were really trying to do is be able to combat that with real hard on-the-ground information, so that people could get their news from elsewhere. They didn't have to be looking on you know, CNN or wherever else to find out what was going on. They could just tune in to Radio Venezuela en Vivo and find out exactly what was happening in multiple languages at the same time. And it was really, really amazing. It was an extremely powerful experience. We did it in November 2007, also in the elections we did it a little bit for the elections in Bolivia that were, you know, there was the autonomy elections that were going on, and we were trying to just get the word out about what was really happening in Bolivia. There was numerous people involved. Fred Fuentes, one of them, who's the editor of Bolivia Rising. It's a fantastic website if folks out there don't know about it.
What is it again?
Especially Bolivia Rising.
BoliviaRising.org.
Mm-hmm. And especially important right now with everything that's going on with Evo Morales and in the Senate there. But so that was that. Then we did it again last fall for the regional elections, and really the idea of the initiative, it's a, you know, 24-hour newscast in multiple languages going on during the elections, or say, mm-hmm, 2 or 3 days lead up. Now, you know, since the last year, I've been more focused in Brazil, in southern Brazil, so I actually couldn't participate in the last couple of times, but I was listening in long distance and also participating as best as I could. But it was really fascinating because somebody took the initiative up, and during the Salvadoran elections just last month, they were doing pretty much the same thing. It was El Salvador Radio Sin Miedo. Mm-hmm. And so the same idea, and it's really exciting because the idea is that we're here observing this, and we have the ability. It's pretty much free. You just have to have a computer in front of you, connect up to the internet, and set up your webcast, and you can be reporting. And it's extremely important, and more people out there should be doing it. So I highly recommend folks to get involved. Radio Venezuela en Vivo will definitely be continuing and be reporting on future elections, and we're also contemplating possibly moving to a weekly show or a biweekly show, and we're trying to figure things out there on that front. But that's really what it's about, you know, grassroots radio, media, trying to bring the information directly to those of us that are looking for alternative news sources, and just sometimes it's really hard to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, even more so up here in the States, actually.
So exactly.
Everything is dominated by these corporate interests. Talk a little bit about your wife is a Brazilian filmmaker. My understanding, Brazil is the government in Brazil is somewhat more. in line with the American government, or has a enjoys a better relationship with the American government than maybe Venezuela does. What are some of the main differences in what's changing about Brazil right now?
You know, it's a really good question, and I think for your listeners, hopefully, let me try and put this into perspective in about 20 seconds here.
Okay.
In Venezuela, although you talk about this leftward shift, you really do have two types of left politicians or progressive politicians in Latin America. You have the Hugo Chavez, which would include, say, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, and whatnot. And then you have folks like Lula, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, or Lula, who's Brazil's president, Michelle Bachelet from Chile, Tabaré Vázquez in Uruguay, who came to power, obviously, to come to power in each of these countries, they had to break a very a stranglehold that the right or center-right parties have had on the political systems for years and years. So just the simple fact that they came to power is extremely important. But they're not willing to, say, take the revolutionary steps that, say, you know, Hugo Chavez or Evo Morales are about to. So that's just, you know, taking the concept so that people understand that when you talk about the left, it's really important to talk about, you know, there are really two different types of leftward, well, there's many different, but two different types at least of leftward leaders. Now, Lula is really interesting. When he came to power, it's kind of the same deal. You know, the oligarchy in Brazil is extremely, extremely powerful, especially in the media. It was his fourth try at the presidency, and he had to basically shake hands with centrist parties in order to get to power, which is the same situation as Tabaré Vázquez in Uruguay. The Frente Amplio was extremely radical in the 1970s, but to come to power, they had to, you know, shake hands with the center, and the same thing with El Salvador, you know, with Funes, who just won last month. Mm-hmm. So that's important to understand how these people came to power. Now, in many of those cases, if they've come to power by kind of shaking hands with the center-right, then they're not really able to break the stranglehold of the system that, say, Evo Morales or Hugo Chavez have been able to. Lula has been making, however, very large gains. He's one of the most popular presidents in Brazil's history, and if you speak with most Brazilians, they'll say, yes, he's the best president we've ever had. I think his popularity is somewhere between 60 and 70%.
Wow.
But the programs he's been implementing are more reformist rather than, say, revolutionary, although, you know, obviously they're helping things. But, yeah, he's definitely kind of put himself up as the mouthpiece, I guess, for Latin America, because he can kind of straddle the two lines. You know, he's very, very friendly with Hugo Chavez, but he can also... you know, he doesn't have a problem visiting with the United States. And it's kind of good in that sense. I guess they kind of play the good cop, bad cop in a sense. You know, they could say, well, you know, at least Lula is, you know, still walking down, you know, and following the policies in the IMF and the World Bank. But boy, that Chavez. But, you know, then when Lula really steps up, for instance, he's really been stepping up for Cuba lately and saying, you know, listen, we need to end this blockade. And that might actually have some weight, you know. So it's been interesting. Obviously, the leftist parties in Brazil have not been pleased with the Lula presidency, and the MST, which is the landless movement, landless workers movement. You know, they hoped a lot more in terms of agrarian reform, and within a year, they knew that was just wasn't going to happen. And partially, it has to do with the fact that one of the main exports that Lula has really, relied on is the agro industry. Mm-hmm. Whether it's biofuels, for instance, he was signing agreements with Bush in 2007 to increase biofuel production and ethanol production and whatnot, or soy, or even cane or eucalyptus or whatnot. So it's a difficult situation. You know, he's trying to kind of walk this line. Of course, the MST hasn't liked it, and definitely large sectors of the PT, which is the Workers' Party, broke off within a year and formed a new party called PSOL. So Brazil, it's in a difficult situation. In fact, the MST says that agrarian reform has actually been worse under the Lula government than in past administrations. But at the same time, it has its ups and downs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's important, though, is also to look at, when we look at Latin America politics, is, for instance, I live in Porto Alegre. My wife is from just outside of Porto Alegre. Porto Alegre, about 20 years ago, was like the hope for socialism in Latin America. And now it's run by an extremely rightist and some would say even fascist governor, and the mayor of Porto Alegre, who's just won his second term, is kind of gutting participatory budgeting in many ways. So it's difficult, and you know, some would say, well, we need to look at Porto Alegre and see what's happening there, what's happened there over the last, say, 10 years since the Workers' Party left, to also see how you know, leftist governments are going to kind of weather the next, say, 10, 15, 20 years, especially through next elections. I guess that'd be, you know, some people might be saying, well, no, that's looking too far out, but then it just depends on, you know, your vision. So, but it's definitely, it's exciting. Latin America is an extremely exciting place right now. There's huge amounts of change happening. There's many, many alternatives, and we in the North need to be looking south to say, well, you know, what can we support with? What can we take from this? You know, and how can we build this in our own communities?
Wow, Michael Fox, thanks so much for being here. If my listeners want to try and get a hold of a chance to see Beyond Elections, where do they find it online?
They can just go straight to our website, beyondelections.com. Very simple. There, they can either purchase a copy. Our distributor is PM Press, and they're fantastic. And we have a link right there, and wonderful. They can even watch it online. So. Visit us at beyondelections.com, and thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Michael. It was fascinating work. Thanks for all the great work you're doing down there. I really, really appreciate you sharing it with my audience today.